two main models, opposites in synthesis and extraction. We've talked about extraction and the Gnostics. I've looked at a couple of examples. Now, again, what I'm trying to do is two things here, sort of give you a overview of the book, and then look at certain little parts of it just to get you familiar with Jung's thought process. How is this book constructed? And he goes from Manichaeism to extracting meaning from experience. And then for a while he just gives parallel images of this extraction image motif in other myths. That's how he works. He gives you an image. Rather than linearly pursue it, he associates to it. He gives you similar images that say the same or similar thing. What he then does is go from the Gnostic idea of the light of God caught in matter to the alchemical idea of the scintillate, S-C-I-N-T-I-L-L-A-E, middle of page 3. The scintillate are little sparks of light in matter in the alchemical mind. That, in Jung's interpretation of it, is simply a reference to the fact that concrete earthly events and the unconscious's response to them carry understanding. There is a message to be had from within them. It's as if there is an understanding in the physical world which is mixed in with events, and when we get into a mess, what we have to do, if we're following the line of the unconscious, is hear that. I'm just saying in different words what I've already said. Now, he makes another leap. We're going from Manichaeism, and then we go to scintillate. Sometimes these little spots of light are called fish eyes, oculi piscium. And that then is a segue for Jung to talk about the symbolism of eyes. So you see how he works? He gets an image, he associates to that Manichaeism, to specks of light being called fish's eyes, to symbolism of eyes in general. That's what's so confusing about this book. His chain of association isn't logical. It's following the common theme of an image. What I want to do is just take a moment to look at the symbolism of eye, E-Y-E. So when we see people have dreams of speckles in matter, or another very typical way this shows up is dreams of starlight. Stars are little speckles in matter, in a way of speaking. Jung then is showing us how we can think symbolically to get to the bottom of the idea of the speckled light in matter. Up to now, our discussion of this extraction has been pretty much from our point of view, that there is a understanding in an event for us to grasp. But if you can flip your mind 180 degrees and put yourself in the place of matter, there is a knowledge in material events that is looking back at us. You follow that leap? This is a weird. This is a different idea. If you simply extend what I've said so far, that in physical events there is a message to be heard. Another way to say that is that in events there is a knowledge of what needs to be communicated. I've just changed my point of view from my point of view to the knowledge that's in that event for me. The way that knowledge will show up in dreams is as speckles, stars, or eyes. In other words, for Jung, there is another consciousness beside the consciousness of the ego. Events and the emotional reactions to our events. It might be more clear to say that the other way around. Our emotional reaction to events, and as we will pursue later down the road and make a lot more of, events themselves maybe have a knowledge of us which is looking at us.
Did you say our response to events?
No. The events.
Well, it's not so hard to grasp that there's an intelligence in our emotions. But where we're going to take that eventually down the road is there a knowledge apart from the ego in events themselves? Let me at least build the bridge here. We'll eventually pick it up. But you're all familiar with synchronicity, right? Think about it. If I'm stewing over a tense emotional situation, it is not, for this group anyway, it's probably not such a leap to realize that those emotions hold a message for me. So it's as if that emotion knows something about me I don't. So there's a knowledge in that emotion. Emotions are not simply biological phenomena. There is something in them that knows me, otherwise how could it hold a message for me? Now, if you, again, this is really a little bit off on point, but just so I don't completely confuse you with some of these leaps. Emotions are often accompanied by synchronicities. If you are cooking in a particularly tough situation, the outer physical world may respond in a way that is analogous to that emotion. And we've all seen, probably if anyone's done inner work, you know you can have a dream which actually precedes an event that happens. Is this making sense? So if we say that emotions hold a message for us and therefore must have an understanding of us, and if synchronistic events in reality can echo that, then reality itself must have a knowledge of us. That doesn't make sense. Don't worry about it. We will come back to it. Yeah.
Those events, then, would they draw not only you into it, but the other people?
Yeah. That's certainly Jung's later point of view, which you will get to probably next fall, that maybe events don't just happen, but maybe events draw us into them, knowing we need to grasp what they hold. I know this contradicts everything that science has ever said, but Jung's point of view is that science's problem. This is the way life is. We have yet to understand this, but if you look at dreams, it's as if there is sometimes a magnet in us drawing a certain experience to us, drawing to produce these emotions. Both the emotions and the event apparently have a knowledge of us, which suggests that there is a knowledge in places other than our consciousness.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, we usually think of history as something in the past that's pushing us forward, there's a theory that the future is an attractor that's pulling us forward.
Absolutely. Definitely. Now, when do you look at cause, when do you look at purpose? That's a whole other issue.
Well, astrology works from this point of view completely, that there is, an energy field that is in motion, that is independent of us, and we get to participate
right.
in it.
Yeah. So, what the point I'm trying to get to, and to do it in a way that doesn't just leave you completely hanging in big jumps, is that there's a knowledge apart from the ego. that knowledge, apart from the ego, whether you want to say that is in your emotional life, your instinctual life, or you are comfortable saying it is somehow in physical events themselves, is what is symbolized by eyes in dream. So you can have a dream of being looked at. And what is seeing you is a knowledge of you that is not you. Now for Jung, that is simply a basic constituent of the human being. That there is a knower in you apart from you knowing yourself, and it knows you.
There's a kind of a parallel in Hinduism. When Hindus go to a temple to worship a god, there's a term, a concept of what's called darshan, where not only are they going to see the god or that idol that represents the god that they're going to worship, but the god also sees them, so they go to receive their darshan. For them, they present themselves to be seen by that god that's in that matter.
Absolutely.
And I know them.
And so we've gone now from you know, extraction to scintillate to fish eyes to eye to another consciousness looking at us. So that light that we're trying to extract from experiences is another point of view looking at us. Yeah.
And what's the relationship of that consciousness and our ego consciousness? Or
well, I could answer that on a couple different levels. Let's say, to give you an initial answer, not much. Because in most of us, there's a great split between the way we see ourselves and the way we are seen by this inner eye. And what we're trying to do in our analytic work is bring these two into harmony, so that we begin to see ourselves the way this viewpoint in us is looking at us. Along with what John said, one of the earliest representations of God is the eye. Can you see the eye upper right? That's Egyptian. The eye. That's Egyptian. Eye of Horus, see it there on the right? That's Jakob Burma, medieval mystic, depicting God as the eye that sees him.
What is it French? I love
No, I think it's actually German. Je is I in French, but in German it's the more. Je liebe, je länger. I don't think that's French.
Oh, okay. So
that's love.
I love.
The more loving, the longer. I think would be the translation in German. I think. Because in French it would be je t'aime.
Je plus.
Yeah. But in German it's ja. Je liebe, je lange.
As opposed to E, so J E may not I, it may be something
else. J E in German means the more.
The more, okay. Thank you.
I think. I'm not sure what that says, but that liebe and lange is definitely German. One of my favorite pictures of Chagall, the working by the eye of God. Well, I thought I would put a little Edinger in here. He does a wonderful job about this eye. So you see, all we've done now is taken this basic idea of the spark in matter and saying it's not just some dead knowledge. It is a living entity buried in experiences which we are being invited to understand through these chaotic situations. He's just broadened the argument. And so, you know, sort of like John was alluding to, you could say, do we get into messes and then see ourselves through this eye, or is this eye arranging these messes in the first place, so that we begin to see ourselves through another point of view? And usually that point of view shows us how we are not living up to our potential. Evinger puts it very lovely, in a very lovely way. I'll take the time to read it to you. I think it's one of the most beautiful things he's written. Last paragraph from page 3. The ego and consciousness itself is born out of the initial split between subject and object. So a little kid goes from saying, me want to I want. I develops, the world is the other. The subject is the ego, and the object, the subject is the ego, and the object is the other, which is, first of all, experienced as the world in its multitude of manifestation. Then it is experienced as one's body. And eventually the unconscious becomes a kind of inner other. You all follow that? In other words, you think, oh, I interpret my dreams. That's what you think. That's the beginning sense of what we do in analysis. I understand them, because you don't realize they are understanding you, is what we're coming to. Those double lines means just paragraphs. With the split of subject and object, the ego establishes its existence as a knower, the seat of knowledge. It is the entity that sees and that knows. And a major feature of ego development is the wider and wider extension of the range of the ego's knowing and of its being able to perceive the whole world of objects as something separate to be manipulated, propitiated, or relating to in one way or the other. In other words, you develop a sense of being able to make decisions and determine how your life goes. You know, a lot of people can't do that. So ego development is a feature of all psychology, Jungian psychology included. Being able to make decisions and determine where you're going by decision. But if an individual is destined for a certain level of psychological development, a time comes when subject and object are reversed. In other words, when the ego, who all its life has experienced itself as the knower, becomes instead the known object, then the state of subjecthood is transferred to the other, and the subject, the ego, becomes the known object perceived by that other subject. In other words, you begin to realize that you don't only know the unconscious and your dreams, but there's a point of view in you which is a subject looking back at you, and you are the object of its knowledge. When that state of affairs dawns on the ego, it is a cataclysm. The ego, in its familiar understanding of itself, disappears or dissolves because the ego is deprived of the basis of its sense of identity, of being the subject and the knower. Instead, the other, either an outer figure or the inner object, or both, becomes the center, the perceiving entity, which knows the ego as an object. I'm going to skip a little bit here. Go down to where it says, but if one works, then about 5 or 6 lines, but if one works regularly on dreams, the experience of being the perceived object of another consciousness will be more and more applied to the unconscious itself. Because dreams are expressions of the self and derive from a center of knowing outside the ego. Dreams are therefore events in which the ego, if it pays attention to dreams, begin to realize that it's being seen and known from another standpoint. And then the goal of therapy at that point is to begin to try to surrender our understanding of ourselves and to be able to see ourselves from the inner point of view that sees us from its perspective, and then to come into accord with its view of ourselves. In other words, in dreams, the ego is the object of another knowing subject. So serious dream work will lead inevitably, if it is carried far enough, to that shattering realization that one is being seen and looked at and is under constant scrutiny by the eye of God. Of course, one can do a lot of dream work before that full realization dawns, and one can entertain the idea theoretically. Oh yes, that's true. But the full implication doesn't often penetrate. Yet if one goes far enough, sooner or later, the full realization does dawn, and then out of that realization, out of that reversal of centrality, that the experience brings about, comes the rebirth that Jung speaks of. It is at this point that circular symbols appear, and the demoralized ego, which had its props knocked out from under it, undergoes a reconstitution. It emerges with a new attitude, a religious attitude. It has now had an experience of the transpersonal other and achieves a relationship to that other center. That's what gives the ego the celestial attributes associated with the apotheosis stage of the process. In other words, you begin to see yourself from this other point of view, and by realizing you are coming into accord with a deeper view on you, your confidence and sense of sovereignty in the world grows.
Can you give an example of how that happens in a person's
dimension? They begin in a dream to see themselves, and the person who is looking at them either approves or disapproves. And generally, it's accompanied by, at the first step, shame, that they don't want to be seen as the other person is seeing them.
I just think that experience, something like that happened with a person I'm seeing who had an emotional discharge, a neurotic discharge of this emotional energy in which there was some fantasy, you know, associated with it, in which the person got the message loud and clear. You're not who you think you are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. And it becomes even more graphic where in the dream you see yourself being seen. And you see the point of view of the seer back on you. And you have to ask yourself, am I the person that other EYE has in mind for me to be? And generally, we are not. So, again, expanding this idea of extraction to realizing that the dimensions of what is extracted. Ultimately, we are finding within events, within our unconscious reaction to them, a view back on ourselves. That these lights really are a separate consciousness.
Do you think that's where some of the language of the mystics where they seem to be so negative towards themselves?
Yes. Well, Burma was a mystic. And I think this is where Jungian psychology really steps into its own. That consciousness is not merely an ego phenomenon. And this consciousness is not reducible to any past experience. It's intrinsic. If you wanted to give it a word, I think it would be conscience. Real conscience, not superego laws, but am I fulfilling my life or am I not fulfilling my life? Burma, the guy who did that, Boehme, I think he was 16th century. You want to chew on that at all? Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that they compared the fish, the eye never closing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you understand this, it really does make a lot in the Bible make sense. But where the Bible messes up, it puts it in a moral framework. And it's not that this viewpoint isn't moral, but its morality is different. Its morality is, are you fulfilling why you are here or not? And if you have to make some mistakes and break some laws along the way, well, that's okay. As long as you're serving the bigger.
I don't know that the Bible really does that. I think it's more the people that are governing the institutions that derive that from the Bible. I think scripture scholars are a huge challenge to institutional church.
Well, that's for sure. I agree with you there.
So, Gary, this is what I read also in Bruce's discourse. The discourse is, you know, the same concept in the consciousness and doing away with ego, which we talk about. It's not, you have to have a strong ego to do away with your
right.
ego, but it's also observing. You know, that whole meditation thing from a Bruce standpoint, you are observing and you learn to live that in your living life, as well as from a meditative standpoint. So.
Yeah. You know, one of Jung's last dreams was that he came before a yogi. And he thought, is this the dream? And then he realized, no, I'm the yogi's dream. When he wakes up, I'll die. You know, I don't wish to try to define any metaphysical reality, but I think the thing that we're left with, which is without a doubt relevant, is that we are being seen. Now, you can say that's God, you can say it's Buddha, you can say it's the world consciousness. It doesn't matter. The question is, how are you being seen, and what are you going to do about it? That, to me, is crystal clear. Well, then, let's... What we've got now before us is all the basic ideas, the two main ideas, the opposites and synthesis, and the extraction. We took sort of a detour, a Jungian detour, through some related themes to get to consciousness located in places other than our ego. Where that is, we can hold open and come back to. But the next passage I wanted to give you is simply an example of extraction. So you hear how this stuff looks when it appears in alchemical texts, which is Jung's metaphor, and then how Jung has worked with it. Just to make this a little easier, I have not cited Jung, but I've given us Edinger's commentary on a passage by Jung. It's just a little easier. But eventually we'll come back to some of Jung's primary paragraphs so you can wrestle with that, but let's start easy. So this is a text. In Mysterium, which is on paragraph 7783, if you care. Paragraph 7783. It's paragraph 77. It's the quote is listed at the end of the quote on top of page 5. And it comes from Mysterium Lectures, this wonderful book. I'm just trying to simplify. The alchemist is Arabian. Or let me say he's an Arab. He's actually Persian, I think. We're starting at the last paragraph on page 4, and it goes over to the top of page 5. And Senior is his name in the West, but I forget his name in Arabic. He's actually an Arab. Remember, alchemy went from Egypt to the Muslims, back to Europe. So many of our early sources of alchemy are actually from the Arabic culture. And they came back partly through the Crusades and partly up through Spain when the Arabs shot up through northern Africa up into Spain in France. So this is a Arabic text. A child is to be born. This is Edinger summarizing it, by the way. Remember this, he says, this is an alchemist speaking, so the child is the phileus that's to be born out of the alchemical text, out of the alchemical retort. Phileus would be the end point, that guidance from the unconscious that we are trying to find. A house must be built for its birth, and this house is the alchemical vessel. The text says that this house is actually a tomb inhabited by either witches or serpents, or both, who feed off the blood of sacrificed black goats. These infernal creatures fight with each other, copulate with each other, and conceive and give birth all in an unholy composite, a mess. See, that's the mess of life that we've been talking about. The text says that they remain in this state in the tomb house for 40 days, the length of the opus. At the end of it, the male serpents cast their semen on the white marble. Ravens gather this semen and carry it to the tops of the mountains. The ravens then become white and they multiply. So you can see the Gnostic reference in that, the same idea that the in the text, that the message is achieved by a sort of seduction. You have to seduce it out of the experience. Now, Edinger interprets. This describes a process going on in the alchemical retort. It's easy to forget that because the imagery, it is easy to forget that because the imagery gets so picturesque. The child to be born out of this tomb vessel is the lapis, the son of the philosophers. But the contents in the vessel are black, evil reptilian, serpents, witches, and blood of black goats. It's a real witch's brew. But that vivid feature is also what makes it so valuable for us psychologically, because it corresponds to a certain aspect of unconscious stuff when first encountered. It's very noxious, that's what I was talking about, the difficult experiences. And it is crucial that this noxious stuff be contained for the 40-day period. In other words, you have to begin owning that it's you and that it's coming from a part of yourself, and not let it spill out into the world in terms of blaming or acting out. If it seeps out into the environment, the result is all sorts of evil, vicious, paranoid activity. So you're blaming somebody else for what you've got inside yourself. If it's subjected to the 40 days of containment corresponding to Christ's 40 day temptation in the wilderness, then it is transformed. That transformation is described by the interesting image of the serpent's semen being cast out, being cast onto the white marble. The creative power is extracted from the dark contents, from the reptilian level of the psyche, and is transformed to the upper realms, to the ravens. The effect on the birds who gather it up is to transform them from black birds to white birds. Just giving an imagistic form, this idea of extraction out of experience, containing the chaos of the experience until the message of the experience gives itself up.
Vessel.
Retort is another word for vessel. So in the dreams we looked at the dove would be like the semen, and the liquid in the coconuts would be parallel to the semen. Something has to come out of that experience in terms of the forward movement of your life.
So what does that mean by the serpent seeming to be cast in the right
spot? Probably clarity, that you have to see clearly what is hidden in the dark complicated experience.
I'm sure I should know this, but it's 40-day thing that keeps the tears in the Bible and all the tears in the news.
Well, that's Christ's temptation in the wilderness.
Right, that's right.
Uh-huh. Well, that I think 40 days here is metaphor for a long time wrestling with a dark power. Like Christ isolated himself wrestling with the devil and the temptation. We have to isolate ourselves with this inner dialogue until we reach the extraction of its meaning.
Gary,
yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How important is it to isolate oneself? I mean, when one has, there's the blaming, there's the acting out, but then there's also the talking about.
Yeah.
And sometimes it feels like that's a really positive thing to do.
Right.
To not keep it all locked up inside. And then there's the other part that says, you know, one has to hold that in kind of that secret place inside and let it ruminate on you. Any comments on that?
I think you've just said it.
So it's not, it can be either or. Both.
I think in the early stages of this process, we are so used to automatically adjusting ourselves to other people's expectations that it really does take a physical withdrawal. Not talking about it, or talking about it with one or two people that are very special and that you know don't have a hidden agenda for you. I think the great danger, certainly of our American extroversion, is that we go blabbering it all over the place. Maybe down the line you get a little more comfortable with holding your inner experience without it being influenced by others. Of course, what we ask people to do is talk about it in the analytic work, but there, I think, hopefully the therapist is sensitized that when this material comes up, it's not my job to solve that problem, but to help that individual hold the experience in a way to help them be capable of their distress until their own inner voice leads them forward. Does that answer?
How do you deal with your subjectivity in the room with the person that you're dealing with? Which was one of the things Corey was real concerned with in the whole free association process.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on what level of the experience we are. If we're at the level where the individual has been able to accept what the chaos is and is living with it consciously, I basically keep my mouth shut. And if anything, support them, you know, don't give up, because these are terribly demoralizing and times full of doubt. What if I'm wasting my life here? What if this never happens? You know, everyone else is doing this and this, and I'm not. So I see my job is establishing the person's inner axis, not predicting where it goes. Other times I think you've got to be quite active, but sometimes you have to know when to be quiet. Yeah, Nancy.
You know, it reminds me that chemical retort is like the container that it has to get enough heat under it in order to do the transformation.
Right.
And so whatever it is that you do, the one thing you don't do is to try to make it feel better.
Right.
Because in that moment, then, you can turn the heat down.
Right.
So whatever that looks like, you have to be able to contain it.
The optimum amount of heat, I think it can get too hot, in which they can't take it anymore. or it's not hot enough, in which nothing happens. And I think the further you go along, the hotter it gets. And this is where the therapist has to have a surgeon's detachment. Because you want to spare people of pain, but if you do that, then they never hear. They never see the dove, they never drink the water, they never get the creative seed. And that, remember, is always for Jung a mystery. How is it that that coconut held magic water? How is it that that corpse gave birth to a dove? It just happens. That's the mystery.
So maybe the question becomes, what is this pain in service to?
Exactly, yeah.
And then you can determine whether it's a pain that you can help to mitigate or...
Right, yeah. If it's simply you've married one more jerk, well, there's no point in saying, now, cook in that. But get out of there, you know. Hopefully they wouldn't have married if they were talking to you. But they do. I've said to people, for God's sakes, do some premarital counseling, because I see about 20 red flags. And, of course, they don't listen. And I can say, oh, I can't believe I married that person. Well, I can't either, but I tried. There, I think you can speak out. But when the thing is working at depth, no. Our belief is the psyche knows its own direction. And what we have to do is help the people hear their own advice. I love the passage in Shakespeare talking about Ophelia. Remember Ophelia and Hamlet? Hamlet, you know, has to fight this battle against this corruption, and he's betrothed to Ophelia. And Ophelia can't stand it, and she cracks up. And she commits suicide, as I recall. Drowns herself. And the description given Ophelia is that she is a person incapable of her own distress. And that's what we try to offer the individual at this point, to help them be capable of their own distress, and then let the psyche do its job. Marion Woodman, you know, some of you know her, her book, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, is a reference to that, to Ophelia. She's called an owl. No, she's called the baker's daughter in the Shakespeare play. And it's all the rage, you know, take a Prozac. Don't suffer. Well, next, I've got a text that Edinger summarizes, and then we'll look at some opposites. And then I got a text that Jung talks about, where I thought we would try to struggle through it rather than do a secondary reading of it through the primary text, so that should keep us busy for a while. Any questions before we go on? So we've got the basic ideas. We're just going to see examples of what I've talked about for now till the end. The vision of Eurystheus. Second paragraph on page 5. This is Edinger's summary, just to make it easier, and again to give you a chance to hear how the ideas we have talked about show up in alchemical texts, and then how Jung interprets them as metaphors for this inner process. Edinger writes, the basic story is this. The Rex Marianus, the king of the sea, has a kingdom under the sea, and he lives down there at the bottom. Again, remember, this is an alchemical recipe. The trouble with that kingdom is that nothing prospers and nothing is begotten. There are no births because only like mates with like. So the opposites are not understood. The person has not understood what their conflicting tendencies are. In this state of affairs, the king calls for help from the philosopher Eurystheus. Eurystheus descends to the bottom of the sea. He sizes up the situation and informs the king that Agapricus, his son, and Bea, his daughter, need to be mated. So they're the two opposites. So what's happened is that Eurystheus, the philosopher, the alchemists call themselves philosophers, has made a brave descent into the underworld in order to bring this advice to the king, for that the kingdom would prosper. So here you see the descent that we talked about in volume 5, but at a deeper level. Once you descend, you don't just get a direction. You have to create the conditions for that direction. Again, just linking up volume 5 in this. However, when the king takes his advice and Baya and Gabricus are united, the text says, Baya embraced Gabricus with so much love that she absorbed him completely into her own nature and divided him into indivisible parts. So by following the advice of the philosopher, the king's son has died. Now Arisaeus is in trouble. In punishment for this apparently disastrous advice, Arisaeus and his companions are imprisoned in a triple glass house together with the corpse of the king's son. This triple glass house is the alchemical retort. They are enclosed in this glass vessel and subject to intense heat and every kind of terror for 80 days. So here it's 2 times 40. But the heat again, the emotional suffering. After suffering from this intense heat, Arisaeus and his companions see their master Pythagoras in a dream and beg him for help. He sends them his disciple Harphorotus, the author of Nourishment. This disciple brings Gabricus back to life with the miraculous food of life, resurrects him. Pythagoras then says to Arisaeus, "Ye write and have written down for posterity how this most precious tree is planted, and how he that eats of its fruits shall hunger no more." I just gave you here a couple of typical pictures. Now that is not from the vision of Arisaeus, but this brother-sister incest is very frequent in alchemy. You see how Jung then reinterprets Freud's emphasis on incest as the illicit combination of opposites that have been separated. And this also is not from the vision of Arisaeus, but just to give you an idea how often the tree represents the alchemical process. See, the growth from the two vessels and the flourishing of the tree. That's Mercurius there as the means whereby. You see how the two opposites are on either side, sun and the moon. So Edinger interprets. The kingdom under the sea is, of course, the unconscious. And it is unfruitful because the opposites have not yet come into existence. Light and dark, male and female, haven't been separated. So that is somebody who is unaware of their sabotage, their self-sabotage. How their own yea and nay, their own doing two mutually incompatible things is getting in the way of their life. You know, come here, go away. Or any variety of versions that you can imagine, where people say one thing, do another, or do two contradictory things. You know, getting the paper in late, picking the bad relationship, talking liberal politics, but driving a Hummer or something like that. See what I mean? It's that where these conflicts don't jive. These two sides don't jive. When you don't see how they don't jive, everyone else around you may see them and feel them, but you don't. Then the opposites have not yet been separated. The unconscious is a mush. So that chaos is not recognized as being made up of two different parts. There must be ego consciousness to bring about the separation of the opposites, and that's what happens when Arisaeus, the ego, descends into the unconscious. So that's what we're trying to do in the first phase of the analytic work. Take a person's emotional chaos and break it up into the components of their personality which lie behind it, which are in conflict. We don't even learn that the opposites, Gabricus and his bear, and his sister Baya, Gabricus and his sister Baya exist until Arisaeus has gone there. Only then is their existence discovered. See, that's the role of consciousness, to make the unconscious able to respond. Now that they do exist, it is advised that they unite. But when they come together, there is an apparent failure. Cabricus dies. So what that leads to then is not the resolution of your problem, but depression and despair. Following the death of Cabricus comes the imprisonment of Arisleus and his companions and the ordeal of intense heat. In other words, enduring that state of affairs, which lasts for 80 days. As a result of enduring that period of intense heat and terror, that affect-laden condition, hopefully that makes sense, the self manifests in the figure of Pythagoras. Now, the self is what that sense we've been talking about, of genuine, authentic selfhood and genuine, authentic knowledge of where your life will go. As that takes place, the messenger brings the immortal food, which then has the effect of reviving Cabricus. Pythagoras instructs Arisleus to write about how this most precious tree is planted and how he that eats of its fruits shall hunger no more. That tree corresponds to the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. The opposites, once separated, must be united again in the conscious conjunctio or union in order to recover the lost state of original wholeness symbolized by the Garden of Eden. Another example of the alchemical text, which is interpreted in the sense of opposites needing to be recognized, synthesized. Jung studied text after text to try to get a sense of how all of this might appear. Good question. Why incest? Yeah. Again, remember, part of what Jung is doing here is responding to Freud, that incest is a pathological situation. So as soon as you see an image of incest in dreams, the temptation is to leap, if you're psychoanalytically trained, that there's something pathological going on. It's not so bad now, but there was a time 10 years ago when everybody thought they were sexually molested. And so as soon as you see a sexual... an incestual image in a dream, it is taken as a replay of some childhood violation. Now, that might be true. But what Jung is trying to say, it can also be a metaphor. And the reason it's chosen is because it's forbidden. There is something unnatural about this process of becoming conscious. It is much more natural to live your life in a contradictory way, blaming others. I mean, just look at history. That's the natural condition of people. To overturn that natural condition is an affront to a basic human tendency, and so an illicit image is used in this alchemical process to say, it's not natural. It's not natural to wake up and take responsibility for yourself. But it shows up quite a bit, and I appreciate your question, because one naively can interpret, and I've seen people who I think, you know, maybe you have been abused, but I see so much in you that needs to be united. I think this stuff is not about the past, but it's a metaphor, and there are plenty of therapists around who will tell them just the opposite. Oh no, because you dream of incest, you've been abused, and you come to me for 10 years and we'll cure you of it. When in fact it could be a very healthy drive to unite what the person would really not like, would really prefer not to face.
In other words, this process is so alien to us that it takes this kind of metaphor to kind of shock us.
Yeah, it's alien, and I think the metaphor isn't there to shock us. It shows us how we are shocked when we have to begin facing our split. And that it is really repulsive to have to take responsibility for yourself. And it's as repulsive as incest would be repulsive. You know, probably incest is the greatest crime in primal societies. A friend of mine goes to, my colleague really is Australian, he spends his summers with the Aborigines. And you can kill somebody there, they don't care. You kiss the wrong person, he says, you wake up in the morning with a spear through your belly. That it goes against something so fundamental for us to snap out of the comfort of unawares living our life and making somebody else pay the price. And just listen to the news. It's one story of blaming after the other. Jews blame the Arab, the Arabs blame the Jews, the Americans blame the whatever, and whatever blames the Americans, it's all about blaming. Yeah.
What's the drive that's making deciding not
want to
take responsibility for yourself? I mean, is that like a collective drive?
Yeah, it's the basic human condition.
Well, does it also come from that? Another thing of wanting to be taken care of. I mean, we start that way.
Right, but that's the basic personal, basic personal and basic. That's why all the early myths are about mother. You take care of me.
What's the basic human right?
Oh, well, I was being a little bit facetious. She was asking, what is it that makes it such that it's so unnatural to face the process we're talking about? And I was saying, that's just the human condition.
Could that also be part of the whole union, the evolution of consciousness, and that was just the state of consciousness at that time, and we're going through another evolution?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think now we're getting a little bit to our later workshops, but the world simply is not going to survive given technology and war machinery and power if we continue blowing each other. Yeah. I mean, 400 years ago, there was a skirmish between 1,000 here and 1,000 there. Now we have, 82 times we can blow up the world. The price tag has gone up. Yeah.
The victim being blamed with like an incest situation, or like in the Catholic Church with the pedophilia or whatever they're calling it now. What's that about?
Well, I think there is such a thing as incest, and there is such a thing as abuse, and I didn't mean by what I said to discount that there is a reality to that, which is not this.
Right, but in the sense that the person who has been, people don't want to accept responsibility. I guess I get more interested in what society does.
Well, it's a little bit off our scope, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But it certainly is now I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I want to honor both sides. There is such thing as abuse and incest. And under such circumstances, everything I've just said would not apply.
Okay.
That what one needs to do is help the individual build up their ego, because it's been so beaten down. Now, we will get to that when we get to Answer to Job, because Answer to Job is a story of abuse. So Jung does attack that, but not at this point. I'm afraid if we get off on it, but
that's okay. I was just talking.
But I do recognize that
much there, of society's willingness to blame the person who perpetrates rather than
That's part of the unconscious state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Here you have the part of the story where on page 5 where it says that she embraced Thea and embraced the freedom with so much love as she absorbed and completely into her own nature and divided into an invisible part.
Yeah.
Is that is that supposed to be
Well, yes and no. This is an incomplete text. In a complete formulation, both would be destroyed. But you don't get that here.
Okay.
So it's a little bit It's a partial presentation of the process.
So this is the same one guide and the other still.
So it's really not a complete transformation. But that's probably because it's coming out of a more primitive cultural level. Yeah. When we get to symbols of transformation, psychology of the transference, we will see a series of pictures where both are destroyed. And yes, I would say it is typical. The typical paradigm is that the two opposites are together. They're separated, which would correspond to your recognition of the of your complexity. Then, that's where the unconscious takes over. If you focus on that, again, the book is called Mysterious Union. A mystery starts where those two opposites, if you are honestly taking responsibility for both sides, what you do is you generate a movement within both opposites to unite. And when those opposites unite, they are often depicted as destroying each other. And then they die, and then when they are reborn, that reborn entity is a third thing, and it also contains the two previous. That's the full paradigm.
So more typically, it would be both.
More typically, it would be both. This would be a problem. See, this would be where both sides are not being seen, and so one has taken control over the other. Right. Again, I'm simplifying all of this quite a bit. When Jung talks about this text, he talks about that and what that means. I've just tried to stick to your basic paradigm for you guys.
And then when Jung made that statement where there is love, there is no power. So where there is power, there is no love.
Right.
Then that means that those two really aren't opposites. Because
they can't be. I see. Right. Yes. Not opposites in the sense he's talking about. Here.
So what would be the opposite?
Here? I think love and hate. That's the tough part. Well, maybe. But I think in a loving relationship, both of the attraction and the repulsion are both there. And navigating those two is the art of living. Okay, questions? What he does now is go into a discussion of the typical images used in alchemy for the opposites. And then what that means for us psychologically. We'll just do the first soul, and then we'll take a break. As you've seen from the pictures up here, the two primary images in alchemy are the sun and the moon. And very often you'll see the sun above and the moon to the right. Opposites always make us sneeze. Here, our Mercury picture, see how he's between the sun and the moon? There, as we will see next time, a very frequent image also used for the opposites of the king and the queen. But here it's sun and moon. There's the king. And another typical image for this is going to be the lion. The king, the lion, and the sun. We're starting off with just the sun. This is just one of the opposites. The other opposite would be the moon, the dog, the queen, and salt. Salt. We'll talk about salt today. And the other,
The other representative of this one object is sulfur. We'll talk about that. So what we're going to do now is go from sun to, sun to lion, which we'll take up really, I think, a little later, to sulfur. And then we'll go moon, dog, and then salt.
Why are sulfur and salt opposite?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we've sat long enough. Let's take a stretch, and then I'll come back and talk a little about salt.